Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McCallum. Dr. Sheena Iyengar is a world-renowned blind social psychologist and an expert on the topic of choice. Dr. Iyengar's research on how and why people make choices, along with what individuals need to do to make better choices, have indicated profound and surprising implications for people's personal and professional lives. Her insights on the subject of choice are believed to be invaluable to individuals trying to make lasting and positive changes in their everyday lives. Dr. Iyengar presents her ideas on choice to students as the S.T. Lee Professor of Business in the Management Division of the Columbia Business School in New York. She also talks about choice with television viewers as a guest on news programs for NBC, CNN, CNBC, and CBS. And Dr. Iyengar shares her research in scholarly and general publications, including her book titled The Art of Choosing. Now Dr. Iyengar comes to Speaking Out for the Blind to present some of her research and insights on choice with us. Hello, Dr. Iyengar.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
So we're going to first talk about how you decided to become an expert on making choices. This is quite an interesting story. I was looking at your biography on the Harry Walker Agency's website. Some of our listeners may know that they're an agency. That's the world-leading speakers agency. Now we're going to go back to your story. I was looking on that site, and I heard that you were diagnosed with a rare form of retinitis pigmentosa when you were just 3, and you continued to lose your vision during your school age years till you were in the 11th grade, where your vision got to the point where you entirely lost your sight and you could only see light. Because of your total vision loss, your high school guidance counselor recommended that you not apply for college. But that advice didn't stop you from attending school and getting your Bachelor of Science in Economics and your Bachelor of Arts in Psychology, both of them from the University of Pennsylvania in 1992. And you also got a PhD in social psychology from Stanford in 1997. How did your decision to go to college and get each degree transform you into the choice expert that you are today?
Wow, that's a big one. You know, you're right that the guidance counselor I had in high school had assumed that he didn't have to show me the college manuals because, his view was, well, you know, go to Bergen County because anyway, most other blind people would end up on SSI and Social Security. And I remember being really upset about this and, you know, crying about this. And it turned out actually that there was a New Jersey State of the Blind counselor that had been assigned to me as well. And that was somebody from the state. And her name was Judy Kirpus. She's retired now, but she actually made a really big difference for me. And I don't know if it had not been for her, I certainly don't think I would have pursued the college that I did. I remember I was crying to her, and she sat me down in the office where the books were, and she said, well, why don't we just go through it? And she encouraged me to think about, okay, well, we'll definitely apply to Bergen Community. We'll definitely apply to Rutgers, but let's see if there's some other places we can apply to. And I remember as we were going through the book, we got to this page, and she reads Wharton School of Business, and I'd never heard of it before. And she starts telling me, you know, what an amazing place it is and its history and all that. And, you know, I'm kind of getting googly-eyed. And, you know, I came from a lower middle class family. They were immigrants. We didn't really have that kind of knowledge as to what blind person could do or what was the right place to go or any of that. And Ms. Kirpus was somebody that actually came from a wealthy family. And so she knew a lot of the sort of opportunities and options out there. And she was able to say, well, you know, look, I don't know whether you're going to get in, but there's no harm in trying. And what we could do is we could apply early decision. And then from then on, it actually became a kind of mission. So I remember I found out about this in my 11th grade in high school, and then spent that whole summer really just, and fall, really just focusing on, I remember I didn't even apply to many schools. I applied to UPenn, and then I was prepared to apply to Rutgers and American University, and I don't even remember if there was any other options that I thought about. But really, I had my entire everything pinned on this one school, and I pulled all the stops to try to get in there. And when I got in, you know, it was this golden moment. And, you know, one of the things that people always ask me, right, is that they always want to know, well, how do you make this difficult choice of which college you want to go to? And it's funny, but for me, it was because it really was just one choice. I never had to worry about it. I never had any sense of regret. I never had any sense of, you know, which one to choose. It was obvious. If I got into that place, that's where I was going to go.
Well, before we get more into your college career, we're going to talk more about how you grew up blind. You followed bicultural traditions. You grew up in that environment. You grew up in a Sikh family, more specifically. You observed their culture and their religion, and you participated in many American cultural traditions as well while you were away from home. What were some of these cultural traditions that you participated in, and just how did you engage in each custom as a blind person?
Well, you know, it's interesting because in an odd way, I guess you could say I was navigating three things at all times when I was growing up, right? I was navigating being in a Sikh household. I was navigating growing up in America, and I was navigating being blind. And being blind had different ramifications in an American community versus in the Sikh community. And there was this constant trying to figure out how to navigate all these three things. You know, in Sikh culture, I mean, no matter whether you look at the American culture or the Sikh culture, there's always questions, right? How are you going to handle things? Neither culture is particularly comfortable with blindness. They just react to it differently, and they show their discomfort in different ways. And so you're sort of stuck having to learn the two scripts about how they're uncomfortable and how to make them more comfortable and how to figure out what's possible in each culture and how to create opportunities for yourself. So, you know, in American culture, it was that I remember in school, it was tough because I was always the butt of all jokes. And part of what made me the butt of all jokes was that I was, you know, the blind kids. I couldn't see the fingers that were popping up in front of my face. And count. So I was always the butt of all jokes. On the other hand, I was also the butt of all jokes because I was, you know, the foreign kid, right? People just thought I looked funny or dressed funny or ate funny things, right? And I remember I used to wear these long pigtails, right? Because I wasn't allowed to cut my hair. So I was generally just this misfit. And then in Sikh culture, I was also a misfit, right? Because there, my parents didn't really want me to talk about the fact that I was blind. They were kind of hoping it wouldn't get noticed. Because, you know, that's just not the kind of thing you talk about or make salient to people. And so there was always that pressure to figure out, well, how do you hide it? How do you pretend to be, you know, sighted? How do you pretend to just be like a good, ordinary, you know, Sikh girl? And I would say that, you know, it was complicated in both worlds.
So now we're going to talk about your research on choice. One of the pieces of research that you wrote was a dissertation. This was your PhD dissertation. It was called Choice and Discontents. Mm-hmm. And it won the Best Dissertation Award, in fact, from the Society of Experimental Psychology. Tell me more about the research in this dissertation and about the award itself.
So in social psychology, the highest award you can get is if you can get the Best Dissertation Award from the Society of Experimental Social Psychology. And so that, you know, that's sort of an ambition that every sort of PhD student kind of hopes for. Usually every PhD dissertation is submitted. The work that I did really looked at choice. And, you know, one of the things that I often say, And I say this often in a speech, and I even also said this in my book on the art of choosing, is that I could tell you the story about how it is I came to study choice. And I could tell you that story in terms of fate. I could tell you I was born to study choice because, after all, you know, Asian American blind woman, I mean, what is she going to struggle with her entire life? It's choice. So obviously the most natural thing she's going to think about and want and be drawn to is choice. I could tell you that it was luck. And indeed, and there were many fortuitous events that happened that essentially ensured that this is what I would study. I mean, ultimately, the funny story about me is I didn't even choose, just as, you know, UPenn was the one choice condition, I actually didn't even choose Stanford. It was through a series of interesting set of events, Stanford was chosen for me, my advisor was chosen for me, and you could say that that essentially chose my subject matter for me. I could tell you that I chose to study choice. And I could tell you how I made that choice. And I think that that's also an interesting story. And I think the truth is that all three of these stories are true. What I came to study is the idea of the world always saw choice as this positive thing. And clearly it can be a very positive thing. And if you look at the last several centuries, we have many great minds that have thought about the power and benevolence of having choice. But as this Asian American blind person, the big thing that I had to keep struggling against was the question, what choices were available to me? And second, when was choice actually limiting? Right? When was having choice actually a limitation? And I think I ended up getting interested in questions that didn't occur to other people as a function of my own reality. So in my dissertation, I focused first on the big question of, well, you know what? We think choice is a great thing, but it's not regarded as a great thing universally. But it's actually a very local cultural construct. That Americans think choice is so great, but you know what? In the world I grew up in Asian culture, it's not considered to be so great. It's actually considered to be a negative thing. And that one of the first big questions that my dissertation asked was, is choice regarded as a universal good? And previous people had said it was innate to humans that they would want choice. And the first thing I showed was, in fact, it wasn't innate. It was cultural. That you could have people in Asian cultures that would reject choice in favor of having others choose for them. And then the second thing that the dissertation looked at for the first time was this idea that became very important in economics and certainly in our everyday sort of free market capitalistic culture, is this idea is having more choices in the marketplace a benefit? And of course, the assumption was that it was. And in my own work, I began to ask the question of whether there were actually some limitations to us as humans as the number of choices expanded. That was it possible that as the number of choices expanded in our lives, we actually could find ourselves at times worse off?
So another one of your published research works was Rethinking the Value of Choice, a Cultural Perspective on Intrinsic Motivation. This piece featured all of your studies on how various cultures, including Anglo-Americans and Asian Americans, made choices for their own personal satisfactions and fulfillments. And one study in this research featured the groups of Anglo-Americans, Asian-Americans, and other ethnic children and their mothers picking categories of anagrams, and of course their words that are formed by rearranging the letters of other words to solve. So you could have a scrambled word, and then you could figure out from all those letters what word can be formed from all of those scrambled letters. So tell me more about how you had the kids and their moms choose these anagrams and the results of this study.
So it was a very simple study. There were 7 to 9 year old Japanese American, Chinese American, and Anglo American children, and they were all in the same school. So they come to a room, and they're now shown 6 piles of anagram on a table and 6 colored markers. And they're asked, in one case, one group of the kids are asked, which anagram would you like to do? Which color marker would you like to write down your answers with? They choose, they do it. After they're done, the researcher takes away their stuff. They're left in the room and told they can do whatever they want. So they think they're totally alone. They're actually being observed without knowing it. And we watch to see what they do. The second group comes in. The experimenter points to the 6 anagram tasks and the markers and said, I would like you to do this set of anagrams and use this color marker. And literally, the experimenter is having them do exactly the same one that the kid in the previous group chose to do. Everything else is the same. The third group, child comes in. The experimenter rifles through a set of consent forms, or at least pretends to, and says, it says here that your mother would really like you to do this particular anagram task. Use this marker. Everything else is the same. Now, the reactions to being told that their mothers had made the choice was dramatic. The Anglo-American children immediately got hostile. They would be like, you asked my mother? Right? They weren't mad at the experimenter telling them, but they were mad when they were told their mothers had made the choice.
Oh.
The Asian-American children were actually, as they would be leaving the room, they would actually tug on the experimenter's, skirt and say, look, please tell my mom I did it just like she said. So you immediately saw a very different reaction to the idea of mom choosing. And indeed, when you looked at the performance of these children on the anagram activity, you found that for Anglo-Americans, they performed the best when they got to choose. And when it was chosen for them by either the experimenter or their mother, their performance dropped. And if anything, for mom, it was actually slightly worse than even for the experimenter. Now, for the Asian children, they performed best when it was for their mothers, second best when they got to choose, and just as poorly as the Anglo-Americans when it was for the experimenter.
I mean, the Anglo-American kids, why do you think they were more the cranky ones than the Asian Americans?
Because in American culture, we're told that if a choice is important to me, then I should be the one to make it. That's essential for my success and for my happiness. In Asian culture, you're told that if a choice is important, then you need to have the people whom you most trust and respect help ensure that the, quote, right choice is made.
I see. Okay.
And those are both legitimate assumptions.
On to the second study now. You put groups of ethnically diverse fifth grade students to work in making choices while they play this math computer game called Space Quest. Tell me more about Space Quest and some of the choices these kids had to make and even the results of this second study.
Well, so this is a very similar paradigm to the other one. The only thing that's different now is that these are fifth graders, so the task is more complex. It's math. They are given a computer math game designed to teach them order of operations. Beforehand, they do a baseline math test. They don't get a real choice this time. It's a trivial choice. So before they start playing the game, they can choose the name of the spaceship that they're going to have while they play the game. So they either get to choose that, or they're told that the third graders made the choice, and these are fifth graders, so third graders are kind of inferior beings, or they are told that it's the majority poll, like it's what most of their classmates wanted that they're getting. But notice how it's a minor choice. But, you know, but it is an identity choice. So this is our manipulation. Everything else is the same. They play the game. The game scores their performance. After the game is over, they do a post test. So we see how much they learned. We get their preferences on mathematics. They do subsequent games, and we get to see whether they go on to choose more challenging games. And essentially what you find is a very similar pattern. Anglo-Americans perform best, learn most, like math the most when they had that very trivial choice. And then it didn't really matter whether it was a poll of their class or whether it was those inferior third graders, their performance and interest dropped. Asian Americans performed best when they were doing that which they thought was the same as their classmates. They cared about that group. They wanted to be a part of the norm. Second best when they got to choose for themselves, and just as poorly as the Anglo-Americans when it was the inferior third graders.
Okay, interesting. So now we're going to move on to talking about one of the studies that you've done in regards to people making choices just in their simple everyday lives. And I was looking at this CNN interview that you did where you mentioned your study on how people decide to either drink Pepsi or Coke. And you implied in the interview that more people make the choice of drinking Coke than Pepsi. Why is this the case?
Oh, I mean, you know, this wasn't a study done by me, but I wish I had done it. It's an amazing study. But essentially, if you take a bunch of people that swear by Coke or swear by Pepsi and you put them under an MRI machine, and now you squirt the soda pop in their mouth, and it turns out they actually can't tell them apart. Second, the brain's response to the sugar liquid is the same, whether they're drinking Coke or Pepsi, which makes total sense. They're 99% the same formula. Then here's where it gets interesting. If I show you a picture of a Coke can or show you a picture of a Pepsi can, it turns out that regardless of what soda is being squirted in your mouth, if you see the Coke can, the sort of happy portion of your brain lights up. It doesn't happen with Pepsi. So our brain has been conditioned to respond positively to Coke. Now, why is that? Well, in a sense, the ads associated with Coke have come to represent far more than just a drink. You know, the red is the same as the costume on Santa Claus. The Coca-Cola can has come to be associated with America, with democracy. I mean, you know, it's like when you think of America, I think McDonald's hamburger is Coca-Cola, right? It's more than a liquid.
So some of these studies that you mentioned to me are featured in your book titled The Art of Choosing. And I understand that the book's available on Amazon. What other online sites out there have the book available or even in-person bookstores? What other sites or bookstores can our visually impaired listeners buy your book in Braille, large print, or even audio formats, or even print, regular print?
It's definitely available in audio on audible.com.
Okay. So I'm going to now ask about your career teaching at the S.T. Lee Professor of Business in the Management Division of the Columbia Business School. You've taught courses in leadership there, and you've taught to MBA students. So what have you taught your students about making choices for their future business careers?
Well, I do sessions on the things that bias, all the biases we can engage in when making choices. We do zero in on, you know, how do you make choices? What are the ways to develop informed intuition so that you make better choices or at least increase the odds in your favor when making a choice? I would say the more general advice that I give people is that you really have to know what your priorities are, and you can't lose sight of that. And that in life, you got to be choosy about choosing. That, you know, the thing I often say is that, you know, as a blind person, I didn't have the choices that the sighted have. But in a way, that was easier. Because it meant that any time I pursued a choice, I had to be willing to be dedicated to it. Because I couldn't afford to choose on a whim. No matter what I chose, they would be doorkeepers and naysayers that I would have to somehow get around, which meant that I had to put a lot of effort into any choice that I pursued. And I think that what that did was it forced me to really focus on the choices that matter. And I think that one of the really important skills out there today, given how many opportunities and how many choices we have, is the fact that we have to be more focused. We have to think about what is it that matters and only make the choices that matter. So if you make every single choice that comes your way, you will not be productive.
So how did you get the opportunity to teach at Columbia?
Well, I did my PhD from Stanford, and then I applied to a whole bunch of business schools and psych departments around the country. And I actually went to MIT first. I got a job at MIT. I got a job at MIT, Chicago, Cornell. And I went to MIT, the Sloan School of Business. And then I was there for a year, and I was married, we needed to find a place that we could both be at, and so we decided that we would go to whichever school would give us both an offer, and so we came to Columbia. I came here in 1998.
Okay, so what have been some of your challenges? What were some of your challenges as a blind person in securing the teaching position at Columbia?
Columbia's actually been very good to me. I got very lucky. I didn't believe in relying on things like laws like ADA and stuff like that to help me. When I got hired, I made all my disability needs contractual. But Columbia has been very, very supportive. I've never had to have any discussion about my needs. I guess you could say in many ways I'm a spoiled blind person. I had a few struggles earlier before I got to Columbia where there were times when I would have to justify needs that I had, but I have never had to justify any need at Columbia. They've always made things possible for me.
Okay, so
I feel very fortunate.
Absolutely. You're one lucky woman, but definitely you're an inspiration to us all and our listeners who may have just learned how to make the right choices to change and just satisfy their lives for the better. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening, and remember to speak out.
You are listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
By the blind.